Within the past 60 years or so, improvisational comedy has grown from its unlikely birth in Chicago to become the most influential form of entertainment and public discourse in America. In their heyday, programs like The Colbert Report and The Daily Show rivaled or surpassed any other news source in terms of popularity and trust. Saturday Night Live, which has always been a hive of improv talent, has offered some of the best commentary on and antidotes to the recent election. This is more significant than ever, but improv has been dominating popular culture since at least The Graduate hit theaters in 1967. Sam Wasson, an author and improv artist himself, has written a history entitled Improv Nation, How We Made a Great American Art. It is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Sam Wasson to the roundtable this morning. Sam, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Why do you feel that this history needed to be written?
Well, because no one had written it. And why did it have to be written? Because I think improv, anything improvisational is democratic. And for the most part, most of the great improvisational art forms, namely jazz and improvisation, came out of America for that very reason. We are, at our best, a country that knows how to play together, that must play together when we function. So when we're working, we are an improvisational community.
This is a nearly 500-page book, which shows this is a huge subject, which I assume had to have been a challenge, at least in the beginning, to get your hands around it.
Yeah, a challenge is an understatement. I think I had a breakdown. I think at a certain point I realized, well, wait a second, this is just way too big, because not only am I trying to tell the story of an art form, I'm trying to tell the story of how that art form disseminated across popular culture from the stages of Second City to Saturday Night Live to the films of Christopher Guest. And that's just overwhelming. And of course, the story is continuing on at this very moment. So how to say what is and what isn't fantastic improv, what is and what isn't essential, is like dealing with the concept of infinity. So I was terrified, and all I can hope for is that I got it approximately right.
Talk a little bit about how the relationship of Harold Ramis, the wonderful Harold Ramis, a comedian, an actor, a director, who had a close relationship with your parents, of how that relationship ultimately led to you taking on this project.
Well, I've been thinking about improvisation for a long time and thinking about comedy for a very long time, and was an improviser myself for a few years in college. But it was the day Harold died that I thought, wow, there goes a giant piece of improvisational comedy history. And then I thought, what is improvisational comedy history? And there were a couple books out there to help me get started, but no book that really told the story up to today. No book that really said, wait a second, this isn't just an art form that needs to be credited. This is an American art form. We invented this here, and for the reasons I enumerated earlier, you know, we invented it out of the need to be democratic. Once I started rolling on those thoughts, I thought, well, I want to read this book. And like many authors, I started writing the book that I wanted to read because no one else had written it.
So looking at this history, you put this art form very much at the feet of Mike Nichols and Elaine May. Nichols and May, who you believe really invented this thing called improv.
Well, I would say Nichols and May invented what we called improv comedy. But before Mike and Elaine, there was a woman named Viola Spolin who invented improvisational games to get children of all different cultures and classes and separated by language and everything that can separate a person, to get them to integrate. So that really started the basis for this idea being that this was part of the American dream. She had these children play games with each other to relate. They had no other means of really communicating. And then it was her son, Paul Sills, Viola's son, Paul Sills, who took these games and said, what if we put these games on stage and had just amateur people like you and me, you know, non-professionals, play these games, what would happen? And then it was Sills who cast Nichols and May And they just ended up being brilliantly funny. So it was then that comedy came into this. Sills's intention was never to be comedic. It was to create a community through theater, but only accidentally, by the just happenstance of casting two comedy geniuses in this work, that it became improvisational comedy, which is a roundabout way of saying, yes, Mike and Elaine were the grandparents of improvisational comedy, as I understand it.
As you were starting the book, you did get the opportunity to talk to Mike Nichols.
That was the highlight, maybe the professional highlight of my life. I don't know if that'll ever be beaten in my own personal life. I wish I could live in that interview over and over and over again. I credit him with, amongst other things, really underwriting my thesis. I came to Mike and I said, Mike, I just want you to just tell me if I'm wrong here, so just to make sure that I'm not going to embarrass myself. Is this jazz? Are we dealing with jazz? And if so, does that mean we're dealing with, like jazz, an American art form? And he says, yes, I think that was absolutely right. In the book, he says, this is jazz, this is American. And then I said, well, why hasn't anyone else, that's a great idea for a book, why hasn't anyone else written this book? And he said, because it's just too big. had I listened to him, I might not have had that breakdown that I had. So Mike, in a sense, saw it all coming. And he gave me aside from a fantastic interview, which is interspersed throughout the book, and the opportunity to connect with a beautiful human being, which is what he so clearly was, he really gave me this whole direction. So I credit Mike Nichols with a lot. A lot, not just for improvisation, but for me.
But going back to Viola Spolin and the work being done, this also shows the geography of the art form, showing that, yes, it's American, but very much having its birth in the city of Chicago.
Well, Chicago is absolutely essential to this story, and it's because improvisers, in order to be free, they need to have the opportunity to fail. Improvisation, as we know, oftentimes doesn't work. There are so many times we've gone to improv shows and been bored or irritated. Well, that because sometimes it doesn't work. And if you take that sensibility to L.A. or New York, the centers of show business, it won't survive because failure is impossible where the industry thrives. If you're an improviser and you know, for instance, that Lorne Michaels is out there, you're not going to give yourself the room to fail because you want that job on Saturday Night Live. And when you prohibit yourself the freedom to fail, then you're not improvising. So in Chicago, where no one was watching, virtually no one, these young people, and they were young, Mike and Elaine, they were in their 20s. I mean, it's incredible. They had the freedom to fail. And because of that, they could really thrive and grow the art form. And that is Chicago, definitely, all Chicago.
You also, you talk in this comparison to jazz, you make a point that with jazz, you do have to have an ear, you do have to have talent, but with comedy and with improv, it is listening and it is responding naturally.
I hope that's in the book. I've had all these regrets. Did I put that thought in the book? So I'm so glad that came across. I think that this is even more American than jazz in the sense that because anyone can improvise, it's even more egalitarian because I, for instance, cannot play the piano. I cannot read music, so I couldn't get up there on stage and improvise jazz. But I could get up there and improvise. I wouldn't be as funny as Tina Fey or Mike Nichols, but I could certainly do it. I could respond reasonably and respond truthfully, like you're saying. So that makes this art form even more inclusive than what we think of as the definitive art form, jazz.
In the book, you talk about different eras, different time periods. And so when did it really come into its own where people started to appreciate it?
Well, there were a couple moments when it really exploded. One of those, the first of those, was when Mike and Elaine hit Broadway. That gained a lot of attention within the New York intellectual theater community. Then Second City, Second City exploded after that, but not for many years later. It took Saturday Night Live in 1975 to draw America's attention back to Second City in a major way, because people figured out, well, wait a second, so many of these people have come from improvisation. Then Second City really exploded. They were on the cultural radar. They were certainly a hit place throughout the 60s. The Time magazine called them, I think, the Temple of Satire or something like that. But in terms of popular culture, it took Saturday Night Live to really, really bring America's attention to Second City.
I mentioned the geography of Chicago, but also it being Chicago, it lured a lot of Canadians.
Well, actually, it happened the other way around. Bernie Solins, who was one of the producers of Second City, just had an idea. What if we go up to Second City? I know a guy there with a theater. It was as accidental and arbitrary as that. And Joe Flaherty, who was sort of the guru of the particular main stage company of Second City at the time, said, sure, why not? Let's go up. Let's go up to Canada. And so Flaherty took up Ramis and Brian Doyle Murray, and there they met Catherine O'Hara and Andrea Martin and Martin Short and Dan Aykroyd and Gilda Radner and Eugene Levy and Dave Thomas, but Valerie Bromfield. All these people were waiting there basically looking for a job because Canadian show business was really not a thriving industry. But the arrival of Second City congealed all of these talents, and that's how it started.
And then what did television do as far as both SCTV and Saturday Night Live? You mentioned Lorne Michaels, of the impact that television had, and of course giving these people who had their roots in improv a lot of money.
Well, it cuts both ways, because once, like I said, once Lorne Michaels or a Lorne Michaels equivalent is watching you, you start to get scared. You start to think about your career. You start to think about money. You start to think about competition, all of these values that are anathema to improvisation. So that can hurt the work. On the other hand, bringing this into the national consciousness, which Saturday Night Live certainly did, is the very thing that drew the attention of the next generation of improvisers like Tina Fey, Colbert, Carell, Amy Sedaris, Adam McKay. These people, Chris Farley, these people grew up watching Saturday Night Live, so they were the first generation to have improvisation in their sight line from the time they were children. They were the first generation to grow up saying, I am going to go to Second City. So by the time they arrived there, they were so full of ideas and excitement that they were ready to revolutionize the art form. And I think the influence of that last group that I mentioned was as avant-garde and as progressive as the stuff that Mike and Elaine and Paul Sills were doing in the very early days. They really breathed new life into this stuff. And had it not been for Saturday Night Live, they might never have been aware of it.
What's interesting about that, and maybe I'm reading too much into this, but help me out. If you look at somebody like Stephen Colbert, who very much had a background in improv and very much had that training, you compare that to someone like Jimmy Fallon, who had his training on Saturday Night Live, but not necessarily the improv training. It was sketch comedy, but it wasn't that improv training. And you see that in their shows nightly today.
I think so. I'm glad you say that. I think you do see that, which isn't to say that one is greater than the other, although I certainly think one is greater than the other.
I would agree.
But they're two different muscles. You know, and that's an important thing to remember when we're talking about improvisation as a distinct art form. You know, I like to say that this is not Meryl Streep couldn't get up there and do this the way Tina Fey could, nor could Tina Fey do Sophie's Choice. So these are two different worlds, two different skill sets. It's not the same as acting, nor is, to your point, sketch comedy training the same as improvisational comedy training.
Are we in a good place when it comes to the training today of the stars of tomorrow?
Better than ever. Better than ever. If you go to Second City, for instance, today, or the Upright Citizens Brigade, you will see there are just elaborate networks of of classes that one could take. There are more gradations, more subtleties for all kinds of improvisers, whether they're getting improvisational training for the theater or improvisational training for their business. Second City now has started a whole wellness branch of their training, which is basically improvisation for anxiety, which might sound goofy to those who have never done it, but I can tell you, as someone who has a lot of anxiety, that when you learn how to improvise with someone, you learn how to play through your anxiety. And I think that that training that's going on is I think, one of the most thrilling breakthroughs to ever come out of this work.
The name of the book is Improv Nation, How We Made a Great American Art. The book is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Sam Wasson, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure having you on the program.
Thank you, sir, so much. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book, Improv Nation, How We Made a Great American Art, by Sam Wasson. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.